I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, a conversation about an outcry on social media that's prompted a national conversation about missing and exploited teens. Last month, photos of dozens of missing black and brown teens, many from the Washington, D.C. area, flooded the internet. Was the media ignoring them because of their color? Why were there so many of them? Well, a closer look showed that there were actually fewer teens missing in D.C. in 2016 than in 2015, but still, many of the young people who are missing are black and brown. Why are they missing and what can we do about it? Natalie Wilson is the co-founder and CEO of the Black and Missing Foundation. Kimberly Melman Orozco studies human trafficking. Tina Front is the founder of Courtney's House, a nonprofit that works with survivors of human trafficking. They join me on Midday, right after the news. And welcome, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you're joining us today for Midday. Last month, there was an outcry from concerned parents and citizens about the number of missing teenage girls in and around Washington, D.C. It sparked a national outrage. The conversation was prompted by the dozens of missing persons alerts with pictures of black and brown teenage girls that were shared via social media. There were theories and fears that the girls were being preyed upon by human traffickers. The hashtag #MissingDCGirls trended on Twitter. Celebrities and politicians weighed in, and Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser announced a task force and that she would increase the number of police officers assigned to finding missing children. But it turns out that, according to the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, the actual number of missing children has decreased over the last 2 years. Department officials say that 2,242 children were reported missing in the last year, which is 2016, and that's down from 2,433 in 2015. And while some of the missing persons alerts shared on social media were real cases, police say that many of them were runaways who were later found, and, of course, reunited with their guardians. But the question remains, why is the number of missing children so high? And why are so many of them black and brown? Remember, we're talking about 2,200 children. Nationally, about 35% of missing children are black, and roughly 20% are Latino. So why are so many children of color disproportionately represented among the missing, and when they leave the care of their guardians, for whatever reason, what dangers do these children and teens face? So coming up a little later on the broadcast today, I'll speak with Kimberly Melman Orozco. She's the author of a forthcoming book called Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium. We'll also be joined by a survivor of human trafficking, Tina Front. In 2008, she founded Courtney's Place in Washington. That's a nonprofit that works with young people who have survived trafficking. But first, it's my pleasure to welcome Natalie Wilson. She joins us on the phone from Washington. She's the founder and co-founder, and chief operating officer of the Black and Missing Foundation in our nation's capital. Ms. Wilson, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the work of your foundation, the Missing and Black Foundation.
Okay. Well, the Black and Missing Foundation is a nonprofit organization that brings awareness to missing people of color. And not only do we bring awareness, but we assist family in searching for their missing loved ones. And we also educate our community about personal safety. We believe that is equally important because so many of us, brown and black individuals, are being reported missing.
And why did you feel the need to specifically concentrate on young black children?
Well, we believe that many times we don't see ourselves in the media. When a person of color goes missing, they're not in the forefront. And we believe that there should be an equal playing field because awareness is key in finding our missing loved ones. So that's why the organization was created, so there's an equal playing field. Whether you're black or brown or white, you get equal coverage because these families are hurting just like everyone else, and it's not just a brown or black issue, it's an American issue, and it's affecting, you know, us across the board.
Talk about the scope of the problem. I mean, what are we talking about in a community like Washington, D.C., and if you can also speak to the more national arena as well.
Right. Well, the organization was created in 2008, and we have been sounding the alarm since then that there are a large number of people of color who are reported missing, and that's the key term, reported missing. I'm sure there are many more, many thousands more who aren't reported missing. And, you know, it's not just happening in Washington, D.C. We're seeing a spike or an uptick in places like Atlanta, in Chicago, in Detroit, in Baltimore. And we know that, I know that many of these young girls and boys were reported as runaways, but we need to understand what are they running away from, and ultimately what are they running away to, because many of them become victims of sex trafficking, which is a multi-billion dollar industry, and then there arise other issues or challenges.
How many, generally speaking, are girls and how many are boys? Do you have a sense of that?
You know, we're still looking at the numbers. We're still researching, but it seems as though that, you know, it's equal in the terms of boys and girls. There may be a slight uptick with girls that are reported missing, and that's what most likely, you know, we tend to focus on. But we need to keep an eye on our young boys as well. And just to give you some stats, in 2008, when our organization began, 30% of all persons missing were of color. That number has now increased to close to 40%. And each year we see close to 300,000 people of color that are reported missing.
And when someone is reported missing, what does that mean? If a family member or a guardian or a neighbor or someone calls the police department and says, this young person can't be accounted for, at that point, are they categorized in any particular way? I mean, obviously, there are a number of different reasons that a young person would leave the mm-hmm. home that he or she lives in. And sometimes it's their nefarious reasons, and sometimes they're reasons having to do with the child and his or her dissatisfaction with their living situation. I mean, so it runs the gamut, right? But when a call is made, when a report is filed, is it at that juncture that they determine this is a runaway versus this is an abduction or a kidnapping, something like that? How do they know?
Right. Well, you know, people or children go missing for a number of reasons. As we know, some of them run away. There are a large number of children who are missing because of parental abductions. We're seeing an increase in the number of children who are lured via sex trafficking. So the parents or the guardian would have to, when filing the police report, will have to alert law enforcement as to the reason why they believe their child is missing. And what we're also seeing is that a large number of children of color who are reported missing normally are classified as runaways. And if you're classified as a runaway, you do not receive the Amber Alert or any type of media coverage. So what we tell parents is if you know your child didn't run away, you need to speak up and ensure that your child is classified correctly so that they can receive the proper awareness. Because we believe that someone knows something that can help bring that child or that missing person home.
So the police, when they do get that call, they are making a determination with the original report, which is affecting, you mentioned things like the Amber Alert. What do you have to do to qualify, as it were, to be put up to the public in an Amber Alert?
Well, with an Amber Alert, law enforcement has to deem it as imminent danger. So, you know, the individual or the child's life is definitely in danger. Maybe they were abducted and they're, you know, in a car with someone that, of course, they don't know. Or it could be a family member, but their lives their life must be in imminent danger for law enforcement to reach out to the National Center to issue an Amber Alert.
So they would not classify a runaway. You know, if a parent calls and said, my daughter is 14 years old and she's run away from home, they would not classify her at that moment as being in imminent danger.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. But again, we have to be mindful, what is that child running away to? We do know that, you know, many children who run away become involved with sex trafficking.
And what's your take on what happened in D.C. A few weeks ago when there's this big Twitter storm and lots of activity on social media about missing and unaccounted for children mm-hmm. of color? I mean, how did that, because then the police jumped up and said, wait a minute, in fact, the numbers are down slightly, you know, by about 200 kids from between 2016 and 2015. The problem is being very much overblown in social media. What's your understanding mm-hmm. of that?
Well, one, there were a number of incorrect information out there. We applaud DCMPD for utilizing their platform or Twitter to bring awareness to these cases. I think what could have stemmed, the outrage is if they'd put out a media advisory or press release indicating, you know, we will now be utilizing this platform to bring awareness to our cases. And before the media storm, we were seeing an increase in the number of children who were missing that were publicized. But I think, just being ahead of it and alerting the public as to this new tool would have stemmed some of the issues.
Certainly here in Baltimore, we are well aware of the distrust between communities of color and the Baltimore Police Department. Baltimore is not unique in that level of distrust. It certainly it pertains to the D.C. Police Department and departments across the country. To what extent is that a factor in this? I mean, are people in fact calling the police to report children who are missing? Do they have confidence in the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department that they would in fact have their cases investigated and that the police department could be of assistance?
Well, we know that there's a sense of distrust with the minority community and law enforcement around the country and, you know, maybe worldwide. As with the Black and Missing Foundation, we have an anonymous tip line. And if anyone has any information about a missing person, we ask you to please contact us. We will not compromise your identity, but we will, you know, do all that we can to help bring that missing person home. And I'd like to tell you a quick story. There was a young lady who went missing out of Baltimore about a month ago, and an Uber driver who picked her up from D.C. Alerted us because he saw her profile on social media. So that was a tip that came into us. And we were able to contact the FBI and, you know, rescue that young lady. But she was sex trafficked. The predator came to her school, picked her up, took her to D.C. The Uber driver took this young child to Prince George's County. And, you know, because of a vigilant Uber driver, we were able to bring her home.
But you're acting in that instance, it sounds like, as an intermediary. In other words, the Uber driver didn't call the police. The Uber driver called you, and then you, in turn, got in touch with law enforcement authorities?
Yes, we did. So by any means necessary, we know that there's this sense of distrust, as you mentioned, but that should not deter anyone from coming forward with information about a missing person, because we believe that someone knows something, and it could be your loved one who's missing and you would want someone to come forward.
And you work with families as well. It's not like you're just concentrating on the children who are missing. What kind of work do you do with the families, the guardians?
Well, we do a number of things. We coach families in filing police reports. That's an issue that we are, or a challenge that we are recognizing now. Family members don't know how to file a missing person's report. We coach them on working with the media because we want, you know, these individuals to come across well when they're working, when they're in front of the camera. And we offer financial assistance to these families. You'll be surprised how many of them deplete their savings if they have one, searching for their family members, or if, you know, unfortunately their loved one is found deceased, with burial services. 2 days ago, we found a young lady in New York, and we had to help her get from New York to her home in Virginia. So we provide financial assistance as well.
Natalie Wilson is the co-founder with her sister, who, as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Wilson, but your sister is a former police officer, is she not?
Yes, she is.
Yeah, so you and your sister co-founded the Black and Missing Foundation. Ms. Wilson serves as their chief operations officer. And Ms. Wilson, I very much appreciate your time today. Thank you so much, and thank you for the wonderful work that you're doing.
Thank you for having me, and you have a great day.
Thanks, you too. After a break, we're going to be joined by Kimberly Melman Orozco. She's an expert in the study of human trafficking. Her forthcoming book, Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium, is slated to come out later this year. We'll also be joined by Tina Frunt. She's the founder and executive director of Courtney's House in Washington. They work with victims of human trafficking, giving young people a place to stay and offering counseling. It's the only center of its kind in the area that is run by African Americans. Tina Frunt is herself a survivor of trafficking. They're joining me coming up after a break. You can join us as well. 410-662-8780 is our number. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It is midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, our resident foodies Sasha Wollhandler of Sasha's 527 Cafe and John Shields of Gertrude's at the BMA. They're going to join me to talk about food phobias. They'll share some recipes to make even the scariest of foods more palatable. So stock up on your anchovies and join us for this month's edition of What You Got Cooking. Tomorrow on midday, we'll also have the weekly theater review with our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. If you're just joining us today, Kimberly Melman Orozco joins me from the studios of NPR in Washington. Her forthcoming book is called Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium. Ms. Orozco, welcome to the show. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Tina Frunt joins us on the phone from Washington as well. She's the founder and executive director of Courtney's House in Washington. They work with victims of human trafficking, providing shelter and counseling and other services. It's the only center of its kind in this area that's run by African Americans, and Tina Frunt is herself a survivor of trafficking. Ms. Frunt, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Kimberly Melman Orozco, you've got this book coming up a little bit later called Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium. Give us an overview of the research that you've done and what you found.
Sure. So essentially, this book will take readers behind the headlines. It will expose the realities of human trafficking in the United States, as well as encountered by Americans across the world. Behind the headlines, what we see oftentimes happening is that some of these victims, these survivors, they end up being re-victimized, erroneously criminalized, denied services, and they really aren't getting the help that they need to really reestablish themselves and reestablish their lives. In addition to that, a number of the cases that I look at in the book actually show profiles of cases that are being lauded as, you know, the biggest prosecutions in history on human trafficking. But if you actually follow the case to the conclusion, there's either no conviction or conviction for tangentially related crimes that carry extremely light sentences. And so, you know, exposing these realities is extremely imperative to really push forward and really empower people to be modern day abolitionists. And I do this not only by exposing some of these cases, but also including a wealth of information, including interviews with survivors themselves, with human traffickers, as well as consumers of the commercial sex industry.
And Ms. Fruit, you are yourself a survivor of human trafficking. Would you mind if we asked you to tell us a little bit about your personal situation and how you were able to extricate yourself?
So, you know, I've been working on this issue for a long time in the area. And sadly enough, even though my story happened many moons ago, what's happening today is the same exact thing, which is how our survivors actually identify. Because the same process happened to me. So although I sound like a statistic in the beginning of growing up in foster care, I was adopted by a great family, but I met somebody when I was 13 and a half, and they didn't know about him because I didn't see any warning signs for them to know about him. And because he did not, you know, at that time try to have sex with me, I kind of went beyond of not thinking that this was anything harmful to tell anything, like many youth today. And because of that, we formed a bond. So he told me that he also was adopted and grew up in foster care. And not only was he adopted, that his family after a year, you know, which wasn't true, of course, but I thought it was then. So with me, on my 14th birthday, I left home. I was upset at my parents for not letting me stay out past 6 p.m. And I called him, you know, and he said that he'll come get me. And I thought in my head that I was coming back because I was just mad at my parents. I was going to come back in my head. When I came back at 11 p.m. in my head, they would say, guess what? You're safe. You can have an 11 p.m. curfew because I'm a child and I think like a child. And so with that being said, that's not the case. And the case was that he had a home in Ohio, and I'm originally from Chicago, Illinois, so this happened in Chicago. And so for us, he told me that I'll be able to call my parents when I get to Ohio. And so the thing is, I was also listed as a runaway, you know, and I went into the system as a runaway. But that's what happens when you report a missing child. You go in the system as a runaway. So no one sees this story or understands that there was someone that was actually kidnapping, but it came in as a runaway. So that's actually what happened to me.
And Ms. Orozco, this is a common story, evidently. This is as Ms. Fruit is saying, you know, this happened to her a long time ago, but it's still happening today. There are a number of reasons that people, young children, teenagers, leave home. In addition to Ms. Fruit's story, what are the other stories that you're hearing about reasons that kids sort of voluntarily leave? In other words, if they're not physically, you know, violently abducted, what else have you learned?
Well, I think that's actually a key misconception that's disseminated to the public, that it's most often a physical force or a kidnapping. And what Tina had described is actually the commonality as far as what we see. So human traffickers, instead of using physical force, at least if they're skilled and tenured at the beginning, they're not going to do that. They're going to use fraud, coercion, deception, and what she described was a faux relationship, you know, a relationship that was actually for the purpose of exploitation. That's actually the most common mechanism used to recruit and control their victims. And the reason why it's extremely successful in recruiting and controlling is because it creates what I would call a virtual tether, a mental tether with their victims. So instead of using a physical chain, they're creating a trauma bond that actually keeps them in better compliance than a physical chain ever could. And just really quickly, I can give you a quote that's featured in my book by a human trafficker. He was one of the first human traffickers sentenced to life in prison for trafficking a 12-year-old girl. But hearing it through his words as how he perceives the commercial sex industry, I think sheds light into how they speak to victims and how they recruit victims under their control. So domestic sex traffickers colloquially refer to themselves as pimps, and this is what he said. Why does a prostitute need a pimp? To guide her, to love her, to protect her. The pimp is her father that she never had. He's that big brother that she misses, or the boyfriend from back in the day. The pimp is that husband that she fantasized about over and over. He's that popular guy in school that never paid her attention in class. To her, he is what Christ is to a Christian, the blood that pumps in her heart and keeps her legs moving. Without him, there is no her. You must understand, she was put on this earth to be pimped by her pimp. Not all pimps, players, or Max possess the same characteristics, but what we all have in common is a unique way of life and love for women and how they're able to use what they have to get them and us what we need. Notice I said need. We all need money to survive. So that quote, I think, really encompasses their mentality. They portray themselves as heroes and faux lovers and faux family. And that's really how they're able to typically recruit victims, especially runaways and other marginalized youth.
Kimberly Melman Orozco, she joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. She's just read an excerpt, just a terrifying excerpt from her new book, Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium. Tina Frunt joins us on the phone from D.C. She's the founder and executive director of Courtney's House in Washington. You are welcome to join our conversation. We're talking about all of the attention that's now being paid to cases of missing teens, particularly in the D.C. area here in the Baltimore-Washington metropolitan area, although this is a problem that certainly permeates the entire country. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Again, the number, 410-662-8780. Tina Frunt, talk about the work that you do at Courtney's House. What kinds of stories are you hearing from the kids who you're encountering, and what do you do once you encounter them? How do you respond?
So Courtney's House is actually a drop-in center. We're not housing. We work for boys and girls, and we do street outreach from 3 a.m. to 7 o'clock in the morning in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. So our referrals right now are pretty between Prince George's County and D.C., right? So even mixed. We have 60 referrals since January. Our average age at Courtney's House right now is 12 years old to 16 years old. So I need people to understand that a lot of the missing youth that returned home actually are either receiving services from us currently or referred to us. And there are different dynamics. So I think we're hearing a lot about PIMP control because that was my situation. But most of our survivors are people of color, so African American and Latina, either domestic trafficking only, so that would be either PIMP control, gang control, family, and boy/transgender. Each one's broken down in a different category because people are trafficked different ways. And so I think it's really important, especially to have a survivor perspective of understanding the dynamics so you can help and see signs, because many parents actually don't see the signs of their child being trafficked when they're reported missing. So therefore, it's not a tier one. Now, the other piece is I'm on a Maryland Safe Harbor Task Force working group, and that's to create a law. So what actually happens to many of the kids who return home, that they're actually held in juvenile detention, and they're held in juvenile detention as a victim of a crime and held on abscondence, which is a runaway charge. So they can be held for truancy and abscondence. And what they say is for their safety, to put them somewhere safe so they don't run back to the trafficker. And I don't believe that. So we're trying to have a better law, because I, too, was arrested when I went for help and charged as 15 years old for prostitution and put in juvenile detention and charged for abscondence. So we really need to understand the laws and what's actually happened to our youth, people of color, being criminalized for being a victim of a crime.
So, Kimberly Melman Orozco, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, reports that about 90% of missing children are classified as endangered runaways. 6% are abducted by a member of their family. 1% are actually lost or injured. 1% are abducted by someone outside of their family. And you talk about this erroneous criminalization, which Tina Frunt was just referring to. This is a problem that you see as well. I mean, in Ms. Frunt's case, I mean, here she is. She's the one being controlled by this pimp, yet she's the one charged with the crime of running away. That's not unusual, huh?
No, absolutely not. And I think that what she described is very pervasive, even in states that are passing laws in the books that are supposed to, I guess, diminish that element. So she talked about safe harbor laws. In 2015, I published a study. Safe harbor laws are supposed to decriminalize prostitution for anyone under the age of 18. They're supposed to be de facto victims of sex trafficking. But in my 2015 academic study, I found that states states that were passing these laws, we still saw these juveniles being arrested for prostitution crimes, according to the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention data. They were still being arrested. They're still being erroneously criminalized. And I think what Tina described is under the guise of protection. But the fact of the matter is the Office of Victims of Crime and a number of victim advocates have come out against that practice, saying that you're actually harming the relationship, you're harming the rapport with these juveniles and law enforcement when you are criminalizing them, even if it is for their safety. And that's why it is, or I guess it's argued for their safety, and that's why it's imperative to have organizations like Tina's and other organizations that are survivor-led, that are using their resources judiciously to really make sure that they are helping victims, they're reducing criminalization, they're reducing re-victimization, and also putting them and connecting with them with services that they really need. For example, vocational training, education, medical, health, mental health services. And so it's something that we are seeing. It's extremely pervasive. And I think another one of the things, or I guess fixes, that they are starting to pass with more frequency is something called a vacatur statute, so that once a victim is appropriately identified, that they can actually have their prior convictions that were related to their victimization expunged from their record. So it does, you know, facilitate more opportunities for employment, so on and so forth.
Kimberly Melman Orozco, she's an expert in the study of human trafficking. She joins us from NPR in Washington. Tina Fruit is a survivor and the founder and executive director of Courtney's House in D.C. Tina Fruit, you mentioned these various categories, pimp control, gang control, and a couple of others. Talk about a situation involving gang control and a couple of the other reasons that you're hearing from kids. Why are kids? I mean, it breaks your heart to think that a 13-year-old, 14-year-old girl would show up to your facility at 4 o'clock in the morning. She's got to be just terrified out of her mind at that point.
Well, actually, they don't show up at 4 a.m. when we do street outreach. Let's talk about that, though, so we can explain. Actually, a lot of referrals do come from parents, so please know that. And not only do they come from parents, but they come from police. We work with the D.C. Youth Division very closely. So they also refer to us in case managers. So for the gang control side, so predominantly most of our Latina survivors are more on the gang control side. And to be honest with you, it's what we hear about in the news, but we don't hear the rest. For example, some of our survivors were filmed and sexually assaulted on live Facebook Live, or that was the recruiting process when they went to a party and they were sexually assaulted, something was given to them in their drink, and then they are threatened. And their threat is, if you don't do this, I will show this. So what happens usually is it may come in as a sexual assault. I'm so embarrassed, I blame myself, and the rest doesn't come out. And so a service provider is contacted. So actually a lot of our cases come in as sexual assault, especially on the gang side. So you're not talking about kids who are just walking up like, hi, I want to join a gang. It doesn't happen like that, especially for girls, because right now they're being sold, and that is what they do. That's it. They're not moving up in tiers. That's not what's happening. So that's actually how most of our survivors on the Latina side of gangs come to us.
And forgive me, what do you mean by moving up in tiers? What does that mean?
So when you're in a gang, and I'm sorry, I'm from Chicago, Illinois, so you know we don't have any gangs.
Right.
So,
right.
With that being said, when you're in a gang, there are actually tiers to move up, right? So you can become a lieutenant, a sergeant, and there are ways to move up. Either you killed someone, you jumped so many people to move up in the beginning of the tiers. The girls don't know that. They don't know anymore of how you become captain, because that's not how they're used. They're being sold to bring in income to the gang. Any real gang has to have a source of income. So not all of them may sell girls. Maybe some do and some don't, right? But you have to have an income. So the ones that usually have females, they're being more sold for the income.
Tina Front is a survivor of human trafficking and the founder and executive director of Courtney's House in Washington, D.C., who works with victims and survivors of human trafficking. She joins us on the line from D.C. Kimberly Melman Orozco is an expert in the study of human trafficking. She's got a new book coming out later this year. It's called Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium. You are welcome to join our conversation when we come back from a quick break here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. You can give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle if you want to drop us a tweet, @midday. Tom Hall. We're glad you're with us. Stick around. And welcome back. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday here on 88.1 WIPR. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the high rates of missing and exploited children and teens in communities of color. Tina Frunt joins us on the phone from Washington. She's the founder and executive director of Courtney's House in Washington, a drop-in center which she has run since 2008. They work with victims of human trafficking, providing counseling and other services. It's the only center of its kind in the area that's run by African Americans. Tina Frunt is herself a survivor of trafficking. In December of 2015, President Barack Obama named her to the United States Advisory Council on Human Trafficking. Kimberly Melman Orozco is with us from NPR in Washington. Her new book is called Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium, and it is slated to come out later this year. If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780 is the number here on Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Tina Frunt, let's talk about this social media storm that occurred a few weeks ago in D.C. You are working with some of the young girls whose pictures ended up in this Twitter storm a couple weeks ago. Tell us what that was all about. What's your take on what happened? What do folks perhaps misunderstand or not know about that particular episode?
Well, I'm glad you were bringing that up today. There was some misinformation on the Twitter storm and wrong calculation of how many people and such, definitely. But I do want people to know it is boys and girls, you know, and I work with boys and girls. And we do have an even mix. So I think that the truth is being on the White House advisory panel and also helping out all the federal agencies on what type of posters and material they use, many survivors, including myself, have actually been very upset. I think the wrong message has been sent out to people of color. All we think of trafficking is what we see these posters, someone putting their hand down, crying on the floor, people being taken and snatched away in a white van. And so because it is, and because people sensationalize it when they're talking about human trafficking, and they show people, you know, in slavery and we're just like locked in a box, because of that, the reality of what actually happens in trafficking, what we see, we don't believe that it is. So when we see kids going back and forth, and when we see them with grown adults, we still question it, going, no, it's them, it can't be this. So I think it's a lot of misinformation about what trafficking is, why you leave home. And we actually don't even say running away. We say how many times they left home to get the real story, because once again, you can be charged with running away. So you aren't telling them, oh, I went with this guy who's 50 years old. They're not saying that, because you can get charged. And because of that, they still are putting the ones that they are the ones that's in trouble. And to be quite honest with you, I think it's difficult. I think everyone saw on TV very recently that there was a young girl who was 15 years old who left home with her teacher who was 50 years old. All over the news, everyone said, hey, even though she willingly went, she was definitely, and I do agree, a victim. But that same instance actually does happen to all of our survivors, and they are not showcased on TV. We are not getting the FBI to look for them, and we victim blame.
And Kimberly Melman Orozco, you wrote a piece in the Baltimore Sun about a year ago talking about sometimes the difficulty or the challenge of telling the difference when it comes to the sex trade industry of consenting prostitutes or people who are being trafficked as victims. How does law enforcement approach that issue? How should law enforcement and the public understand that? Because there are some people who are voluntarily participating in the sex industry, the you know, prostitution and the like, for a variety of reasons, but they are oftentimes commingled with people who are very much in that industry involuntarily.
Well, first, I think it's an important distinction that a juvenile cannot consent to be exploited in the commercial sex industry. So a little bit earlier, you were talking about gang-controlled sex trafficking. And one of the chapters in my book actually talks about a particular case from Northern Virginia with Rancis Amaya, who his gang name was Murder in Blue. He ran with MS-13. And part of the book, I go into the actual transcripts from the trial. And one of the victims, who was a 16-year-old Latina girl who was a runaway, the prosecutor or the defense attorney, excuse me, asks her, "Is it fair to say that you did not want to go home?" She says, basically, yes. He asks, "Despite the fact that you were being prostituted by MS-13, you didn't want to go home?" And she repeats, yes. So it's important to understand that oftentimes these kids will be manipulated into believing that they are consenting participants in their own exploitation. And that is one of the reasons why when all of the Twitter and social media campaigns came out with regards to the Black and Latina girls that were missing from D.C., I think it actually did a disservice when the police and others came back to say, oh, well, they were runaways. This wasn't sex trafficking. They were runaways. It's imperative for people to understand the way human trafficking happens in real life. In that piece that you referenced in the Baltimore Sun, I say this is in the movie Taken. Liam Neeson isn't going to show up in a black Audi and Versace suit to save his innocent victim daughter. That's just not how it goes down in real life. The reality is it is homeless children, runaways, and others. And even if they are leaving on their own consent, it doesn't mean that they are not being trafficked after they leave home. And so I think it is important that we might change the laws so that we are issuing Amber Alerts and we are actually actively looking for these kids because of their high likelihood of being victimized.
And Tina Frunt, when it comes to media coverage, I mean, you advise the FBI, you advise police, you work with communities and schools, and you're creating awareness. So you're very keyed into how the media handles this. There's been a couple of folks who've looked at coverage of missing and exploited young people, and they found that white children and white women in particular are very, very much represented in the media coverage of this problem, where people of color are not. How does that paradigm get changed?
Well, I'm going to keep yelling at the rooftop, and many survivors, and that's one of the things we're doing. At the White House currently, we're still there because we were written into law. So I'm actually co-chair of the Rule of Law Committee, which is law enforcement. And we are actually redoing all of Homeland Security, FBI, DOD, Department of Defense, training on trafficking. So it can include a survivor's voice and more of this reality that we actually see. I think you have to start there. There are so many trainings, and it's not consistent. None of the trainings are consistent for law enforcement. Know that. And because it's not consistent, they're all learning something different. And because of that, they don't know what to see on the ground. So we're definitely going to, we're improving that and helping change that. I just wanted to end with a follow-up. Karen just spoke briefly about the MS-13 case, and since I did work with those survivors directly, I wanted to comment about that. It's really important to get service providers in the very beginning, and sometimes they didn't have the trauma help. So some of their statements, that's because they didn't have the counseling to even see that they were a victim of a crime. The other part is that I actually have a survivor who's doing amazing that came from being trafficked by MS-13 from that case. And not only that, she's in college right now. She helps the other survivors in our program. So just knowing that it's really important to have services so they can also fulfill their dreams.
Kimberly Melman Orozco, you mentioned that so much trafficking takes place in plain sight. What can people do if they suspect that a person is being trafficked? What are the signs that they might look for to see if a young person or a person of any age is a victim of trafficking?
I think that's a very, it's a difficult question to answer. And the reason being is that in the United States, there are so many different forms of human trafficking that we encounter that, you know, and depending on the population, it really is different. So it's different if it's a runaway that's being trafficked by a domestic human trafficker or a pimp. It's different if it's a international human trafficker that's putting them, you know, in a strip club or another form of the commercial sector. sex industry. One of the forms that is really overlooked is that we have kids that are coming from lower socioeconomic areas that are being trafficked into mag crews or door-to-door sales crews. So, I mean, you might encounter a victim that's knocking on your door trying to sell you an all-purpose cleaner or a magazine or some other good, but they might be exploited by the manager they're working with. So it really, there are a variety of red flags that you can look for. I think the Blue Campaign, the Department of Homeland Security Blue Campaign, puts out some lists of some of those red flags for the different forms of human trafficking. But I mean, you really just need to open your eyes and really look behind the headlines, because it really isn't what you would expect as far as the realities. And then the other piece is, as Tina had mentioned, you know, I am very familiar with her organization. It's imperative for people to reach out and to support organizations like hers that are providing direct services to survivors, because not only, I mean, identification is just the first step. There needs to be follow through and follow up to making sure that these kids do reestablish their lives. And as she had mentioned, they actually can pursue their dreams. And that's why having organizations like hers are so important. And so I would say, you know, work with organizations that are providing the boots on the ground and that are connecting with survivors and really supporting them, their rehabilitation, and, you know, being victim advocates during the criminal justice process.
And Tina Fruit, in this most recent session of the Maryland General Assembly, which ended just last week, Republican Governor Larry Hogan signed a bill that expands the definition of sex abuse to include human trafficking. They call it the Protecting Victims of Sex Trafficking Act of 2017. I assume that's a good step in the right direction. What other steps would you suggest in terms of public policy?
Well, let me kind of explain what that means and how great it is, but, you know, it should have already been on the books, right? We should have already known that grown men shouldn't sexually abuse and have sex with minors. So that's how long sometimes it takes to understand that. I think it's a great law. I push for it, so I'm very excited. Now this means that now the abuse, the sexual abuse youth division of Prince George's County can actually work on these cases. So that's big, because that hadn't happened. The other things we need is not putting them on probation, having better housing programs and programs for parents, parent support groups as well on trafficking as well. And more programs for boys that aren't enough for boys.
At Courtney's house, about what's the breakdown between boys and girls that you're working with?
So, honestly, out of that 60, like, referrals, there are about 26 that are boys, right? And I think that people don't...
So it's almost half, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's always been that way for us. Because of my own trafficking situation, I knew that it affected boys. I don't know why we do that to boys. We know that males are sexually abused, and then that's it. And there aren't enough programs or housing for them. And it's harder for the boys to come get help, but they actually stay in programs longer than girls do.
And Kimberly Melman Roscoe, we just have 10 seconds left. Is there any national movement to change the criteria for Amber Alerts? Anybody working on that?
I think that there is, and I think that following the social media campaign that came out of Washington, D.C., I think that there will be more people involved with that movement. And I think that the more people that are informed on the realities of human trafficking and what's going on behind the headlines, the more you're going to see some real social activism to see change, not only the laws on the books, but also in action.
All right. We will keep an eye on it. Kimberly Melman Orozco's forthcoming book is called Hidden in Plain Sight, America's Slaves of the New Millennium. It's out later this year. Tina Frunt has joined us on the phone from D.C. She's the founder and executive director of Courtney's House in Washington, which she's run since 2008. She was appointed to the United States Advisory Council on Human Trafficking by President Obama. Thanks to you both. I very much appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
For having us.
We'll have links to more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up on the program tomorrow, it's What You Got Cooking with our resident foodies, John Shields of Gertrude's at the BMA and Sasha Wohlhander of Sasha's 527. We'll talk about ways to get over food phobias. And theater critic J. Wynn Russick will join us with her review of Something Rotten at the Hippodrome. Speaking of something that's not at all rotten, we have lunch for our midday guests today, provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. Thanks for downloading the WIPR app and hanging out with us at your leisure 24/7. I'm Tom Hall. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.